Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Robbie Aceto. Aceto is an internationally recognized musician, guitarist extraordinaire, and a composer for film. He has toured worldwide and recorded with such top-line artists as The Heads and Tom Tom Club. He has composed scores for many films and documentaries, including Saved by Deportation, The Unknown Odyssey of Polish Jews, which won the Audience Award as Best Documentary at the 2007 Jewish International Film Festival in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show, Robbie.
Thank you for having me.
Now, tell us when it was when you discovered music.
I think probably around the same time I opened my eyes, the first time. Come from a musical family, and it was very much a part of my upbringing. So there was music everywhere, both sides of the family, and there was a lot of different kinds of music floating through the house.
And what did you find yourself attracted to in those early years?
Well, you know, there was the usual popular culture icons like Bob Dylan and the Beatles and, you know, that sort of thing. And, of course, like everyone I knew at the time, I wanted to be Bob Dylan.
Oh, really?
It was just such a... The idea that you could pull something completely out of yourself and have a completely unique voice, it was really kind of a captivating idea. But we had a lot of people through our house. We lived on the edges of the University of Rochester, and our neighborhood, it was a real working-class neighborhood, but there were a lot of houses that were, you know, kind of like Ithaca, where you have a lot of foreign students, medical students mostly, because of the medical school. And the running joke in our house was that we had everything from banjos to balalaikas, you know, floating through the house. And because people would just end up there, and it was a very open house, and there was a lot of music and a lot of musical nights.
So you got exposed to a whole bunch of different genres and people. Did you start out as a singer-songwriter?
Well, when you say starting out, it's kind of...
Some of the first things that you wrote, was it lyrics and music?
I guess I had... gotten training when I was little, like most people do, you know, started out on piano and picked up the guitar at one point and just found that I had a natural kind of innate sensibility about it. And I didn't really think about writing music until I was, you know, older, late teens or whatever, mm-hmm. and then just started writing things on the guitar and, you know, making up songs. But it didn't really gel until I was, you know, into my 20s and started being in bands and started to look at that as a means of expressing myself. Mm-hmm. So,
Now, in your bio, you're described as a musician who has an unconventional sonic approach. Tell us what that means.
Well, my primary focus has been on the electric guitar. And, you know, when you break it down to its rudiments, you have your guitar and you plug into an amplifier. There's a lot you can do just in that chain where you have your guitar and the voice of the instrument comes out of a speaker. And it's a little different from an acoustic instrument. Beyond that, like an acoustic instrument, a lot of how you approach it physically dictates the type of sound you have. And, you know, the untrained ear would think, well, you plug an instrument into an amp, and that's the sound that comes out. Mm-hmm. But people don't understand, who don't play the instrument, that the physical nature of just the way you handle the instrument, the way you hit the strings, the way you use pressure with your left hand, has a lot to do with the way the instrument speaks through the amplifier. And it's this holistic kind of thing where it's the instrument and the amplifier become one sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an acoustic guitar, and then with the electric guitar, it's the amplification becomes just as much a part of the instrument. There are things you can do, whether it's, you know, physical technique that you're doing with your hands and the instrument, or using electronics and stomp boxes and that kind of thing. And there's a lot of different ways to approach plugging a guitar into an amplifier. Mm-hmm. And I think mm-hmm. people, you know, you can go into it as deeply as you want or not go into it at all and just be content with the voice that you're getting. It's just that the instrument itself is really an open-ended thing, and I don't think the surface has really been scratched, what it can accomplish.
Yeah.
So.
Now, you ultimately ended up segueing into composing for film. What was the reason why you decided to do that?
Well, I had, like a lot of people I know, my generation, my age group, whatever, we were in bands, and everyone was pretty convinced that you were going to make it, you know, and you wrote songs for your band. And I was always sort of elbowing my way against the structure of the song. And, you know, you need to write a song, and it has a verse, and it has a chorus, and it has a bridge, and it has these kind of imposed structures on it. Mm. And I was always sort of uncomfortable with those strictures. So a lot of what I ended up writing for bands that I was in sort of didn't conform to that. You know, here's the chorus, and here's the bridge, and mm-hmm. here's the verse, and you repeat the chorus twice at the end, and that whole thing. So these other ideas started to leak their way into my songwriting. Eventually, I just felt, well, you just get rid of the song, and mm-hmm. what do you have? You have the music. And that was, it just became a lot more exciting to me. After, you know, doing bands and playing songs for 20 years, all of a sudden, you have this freedom of mm-hmm. no strictures, and the idea of just writing music.
So Robbie had to break out of the prison of songwriting.
Well, you know, it's not really a prison. It's just there are, if someone's listening to a song, they have a certain expectation of what it's supposed to do, and then outside that expectation, then you your interest might wane. If you're waiting for the hook, and it's mm-hmm. not really about a hook, it's about something else. So mm-hmm. music can be about so many different things, and when you write a pop song, it's got to be about the hook, and sometimes your interest for that sort of thing just doesn't hold for mm-hmm. very long. Mm-hmm. So that's
now. Were you interested in soundtracks before that? Because I'm somebody who buys soundtracks. I'm fascinated.
Yeah, I love soundtracks.
By the way, soundtracks are crafted.
I had always been interested, especially, you know, you go back to the great works of film and film composers that, you know, you wouldn't normally think of as film composers, like Leonard Bernstein. You listen to his score for On the Waterfront, and it's just, it's one of the most amazing things you could imagine. And I had the good fortune of playing on several film scores. I said, well, this is something that I could do. And it got to the point where I really needed to look for something other than being in a band and being on the road, and it just seemed like a natural segue, you know, to mm-hmm. get into I've always been very self-reliant, a real self-starter, and you sort of dive into something with all of your assets, and you just see where you come out at the other end. Mm-hmm. So,
now, I want to play an excerpt from a documentary, which I mentioned in the introduction, called Saved by Deportation, mm-hmm. The Unknown Odyssey of the Polish Jews. Your composition is called Typhoid in Tajikistan, 1944. Tell us a little bit about it.
Saved by Deportation is a really interesting film because it tells a story that has not been told before in film of the Jews who were deported into exile in Siberia when Hitler and Stalin had signed the Non-Aggression Pact. They started deporting Jews into Siberia to work in forced labor camps in the coal mines and in the forest and that sort of thing. So at that point, they considered it a death sentence. They'd end up dying in exile. But ultimately, they ended up escaping the Final Solution, which mm-hmm. was going on in Poland at the time. So I looked at the arc of the film as really being like a journey, because you take these people who are from a very highly cultivated society, a lot of culture, you know, the great music and literature and art of Europe, mm-hmm. of generations of Europe. And then they're sent into these very primitive modes of living that they hadn't experienced before. And then after they're allowed to leave Siberia, they make their way on foot and by train and however they could down through the southern exit route out of Russia into, they're trying to make their way to what was then Palestine. And they go through the Samarkand and Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. And all of a sudden they're bumping up against cultures that are two steps away from how they existed in biblical times. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got your donkey and your camel, and there's no sanitation, and there's no powered lights, and it was a really so I looked for something really archaic to put into the music, and at that point in the film,
let's listen to a little bit of it.
Thank you.
Wow, that's a gorgeous piece. It really is.
Thank you. Thanks.
Now, do you have particular rituals that you use when you set out to compose for a particular film? Do you find out and do research about place and time?
A lot of it, for me, is looking at the film, trying to get a sense of what's going on character-wise, what's going on story-wise, and also what the direction of the person who's making the film is, and then just allowing it to gestate. And for Saved by Deportation, for the European-type segments of the film, I knew I wanted it to have a traditional European kind of sensibility to the music, but when they go into Russia, it needed to have a folk music sort of element to infiltrate it. And then as they started to cross the desert, the more archaic instruments sort of show up, and I just had a sense of how I wanted it to go. And then they return at the end of the film to Poland after the war. And, of course, there are still pogroms in place, and even though the war was over, they were still pulling people off of buses and shooting them in the street. Mm-hmm. And it was really a dreadful time for these people. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think music for film is kind of its own language, or would you put it in the classical traditions? Do you have any feeling about that?
It's interesting because it can go both ways. It can exist, and you know, it should exist on its own as absolute music. But when you look at it in terms of storytelling and underscoring of, you know, dramatic elements, there are going to be places where it's going to succeed and fail, because you know, you could take the greatest composer, put them in front of a film, and you know, awful things can happen. Mm. You know, it really, there's a whole other sensibility to writing music for a film, and I think it's by studying the great film composers that it's just like if you're writing absolute music, you know, where the story is in the music, and here the story that's in the music has to be amplifying or underscoring what's going on in the film. So it's another whole discipline.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robbie Aceto. He's a musician and a composer of film. Do you think a lot of people who are doing film soundtracks nowadays are taking the easy road with all these pop songs that are showing up in films? It seems like pretty easy work.
The way I understand it, that's really a function of the way the studio system is working, and the budgets for music and film get bigger and bigger. And certainly if you're making a film that you know is going to be a mass market film, that's going to be a popular culture film, the best way to, you know, sort of amplify that is by insinuating elements that are already a part of that gestalt. Mm. And maybe it's an easy way out. I don't think composers are given the latitude that they really deserve, especially the really great composers at work now, Elliot Goldenthal, for instance. And
I like Hans Zimmer.
Hans Zimmer is good. He's found this way to assimilate the popular idioms into his work, and he's criticized by many for his what's considered a factory approach, mm-hmm. where he has a really, because he's so successful and he has a lot of people in his stable and he parts out a lot of his work and he writes the main themes and mm-hmm. does all the fun stuff, and then he has his workers sort of do all of the rest of the work.
Like the Jackson Pollock of film composing. I swear, Black Hawk Down, though, that soundtrack to me is just...
It's very impressive. Yeah.
Now, you've had a long-time love affair with the electric guitar, and you were considered a color guitarist. That's how it's described in your biography. Explain that a little bit.
Well, it's like I was saying before, that you have the instrument in front of you and you have choices about where do I want to go with this? Do I want to just bang out the chords? And banging out the chords is certainly, there's an immediacy to that and an emotional immediacy to it. But emotions don't exist on just one plane. There's a very broad spectrum, and there's very delicate emotions and there's very intense emotions, and then there's everything in between. And I think the guitar is one of those instruments. It's like the piano, where you have the top of the range, the most sensitive, the most delicate sounds available, and you've got the biggest, broadest, most intense sounds available all in one instrument. And it's really, for me, the effort is to constantly expand how much of that range you can get out of the instrument. So instead of following one path, say I'm really good at banging out chords, you know, like Pete Townsend or something, he did something that was so pointed and so sort of instantly graspable and universal in its language. He was able to focus on that and really, you know, make a career out of this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's just so many ways to approach the instrument, and you can get a lot of color out of it. So that's how that word comes up.
Mm-hmm. So it really has to do with emotion.
I think so, yeah. It's an instrument that has a really broad range, and I think the important thing is to see how far up and down you can get.
Mm. And, mm-hmm. Now, I want to play another excerpt from one of your scores. This is from a documentary called Alexander, and it's called Everything Changed. Tell us a little bit about it.
Alexander is a handicapped boy. At the time of the film, he was 11, I believe, and the film is about how his parents deal with the life changes that are necessary when having to, you know, change everything about what you do and how you think and who you involve yourself with because of your child's special needs. And it's a really beautiful film by Martin Bell, who's an Academy Award-winning director. He had tempted a lot of really beautiful music into his film, and this particular cue he used was by Gustavo Santaolalla, and he kept saying to me, "I need a mandolin, I need a mandolin, because I have this beautiful mandolin piece." And then when I listened to the piece, I realized there wasn't mandolin at all. It was probably a trez, which is an instrument from Central and South America. And Gustavo is really brilliant on this instrument. So I decided to use the mandolin, because the trez is a double course instrument where you have the strings are in octaves. And so it has a really unique sound, which then I tried to translate to the mandolin and try to find something different to do with the instrument. So that's how I came about writing this piece.
Let's listen to a little bit of it. Your stuff really does take you into different worlds in many ways.
Thank you.
But you've created original soundtracks to silent film for the Finger Lakes Environmental Film Festival. How does that work?
Well, I've only done one so far. Last year I worked with Jeff Klaus and Judy Hyman and their group to create the soundtrack for an original film by Phil Wilde and Michelle. That was pretty much all worked out by the group when we worked, and Jeff and Judy had specific pieces that they wanted to do, and then Judy and I collaborated on a couple of pieces, and they gave me a little bit of room in one segment where I had my own moment to kind of develop something in an improv way. This year, I'm going to be doing a performance to this landmark silent film called Grass, which was made in the 20s. It's a documentary film about the Bakhtiari nomadic peoples in what was then Persia and Anatolia. This score is going to be a group improvisation with Peter Dodge and Chris White. So it's going to be a completely different thing where we sort of are developing a vocabulary between the three of us. You know, we won't really know how it's going to happen until it happens. And I have a really good feeling about it. I think it's going to be pretty great.
Do you like to collaborate, or would you prefer to work by yourself in general?
Both methods have their upsides and their downsides. I find myself working more and more in isolation the last few years because there's that thing about having only yourself to rely on. It's kind of it's a motivator for me. You're not hampered by, you know, the decision-making process. You can just make your decisions on your own, and you don't have to find yourself in agreement with others. But you lose that sense of spontaneity and that bouncing ideas off of people that you get when you collaborate. So they both have their places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, before we run out of time, I want to play a final piece featuring the great guitar of Ravi Acito. This one's called Down the Arroyo. Tell us a little bit about it.
This was from a commission I had to a filmmaker friend of mine was doing the behind-the-scenes making of a film on a film called The Two Towns of Jasper, which went to Sundance this year. Two Towns of Jasper is about the town in which 3 years ago there was a racially motivated murder of a man named Charlie Bird, who was, I'm sure you've heard the story, he was dragged behind a pickup truck, and it was really heinous crime. And so these two filmmakers went down after the fact, and the film is not about the murder, it's about the town and how it affected the people in the town. And then this piece is from a film that was made about the making of the film, and it had to have kind of a Texas sort of feeling to it, and this is what I came up with.
Let's listen to it. You know, it's a little reminiscent of Deadwood, some of the music in Deadwood, which I loved, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, do you think you'll ever create a solo album of just your own original guitar pieces? I know you had an album of your songs called Code a number of years ago.
You know, I have to say it hasn't really been one of my foremost thrusts over the last couple of years. I've continued writing songs, and I have a collection of songs which often then I think about, well, am I working on an album or not? And you know, you just keep working and writing. If I don't have a job and I have the time, I'll work on writing something just for myself, and I've been stockpiling material for that. Also been toying with the idea of writing an opera for about 3 years, and
really?
I have some material written for that and a couple of songs, and it's a long-term project, which I don't know if I'll ever complete, but I'm running that balancing act between trying to find work and putting my energy into making music for work and making music just to please myself, which is, you know, you try to find some kind of middle road. Mm-hmm. But
now, what might this opera be about? Do you already have the very dramatic subject in
it? It's a very dramatic subject, and I don't want to talk about it too much because I don't want to let the idea out, because I think it's a really good idea. But it's basically about the immigrant experience in the United States in the beginning of the last century. And basically, I came into possession of some notebooks of my grandfather's, when he was an immigrant in the early part of the 20th century. And he went to night school to learn English. And these notebooks that I got a hold of were basically essays and letters that he wrote when he was learning English. I found him really captivating in the sense that you get this little window on this man, who I never knew, by the way, and his experience of this new world. And it's just an idea that's stuck in my head, so it's something I've been working on for quite some time.
Oh, that sounds interesting. Now, do you still work as a backup musician with some of the local people, like Hank Roberts? And
you know,
can we see you anywhere this summer?
The last time I worked with Jenny Stearns a little bit last year, and we did some stuff in the studio, and we did one performance, I think. But no, not really. I work on album projects. I just finished an album project with a longtime collaborator from Canada by the name of Douglas September. He's an amazing artist. I just finished playing on his record, and I'm working on a project with a recording artist in Italy by the name of Stefano Panunzi, and we're doing a CD project, and several friends in Europe are involved, and I'm, you know, working long distance, so he sends me tracks, and I work on them and send them back, and then he sends them back, and I send them back. And
so. Well, Robbie Aceto, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, and I'm actually looking forward to this opera. I hope you pursue it.
I'll try. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.